are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBU to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Britain's elections, an historic Tory defeat. The French elections, something happened. And in Israel, a ruling on conscription and a potential explosion in the West Bank. First, British elections. Keir Starmer will be the next British Prime Minister. In a landslide win for Labour that was long predicted, Starmer will take over after 14 years and five prime ministers under Conservative Party rule. During that time, public services have shrunk, the cost of living has skyrocketed, and poverty has increased dramatically. And then there's Brexit, Britain's decision to leave the European Union, a major miscalculation with regard to expectations of reduced immigration. So who is Starmer? A British journalist, Oliver Eagleton, who has written a book about Starmer, offers an unsparing critique. Contrary to the usual depiction of Starmer as being fairly bland and without principles or plans, this writer says, quote, "His politics are, in fact, relatively coherent and consistent. Their cardinal feature is loyalty to the British state. In practice, this often means coming down hard on those who threaten it. Throughout his legal and political career, Mr. Starmer has displayed a deeply authoritarian impulse, acting on behalf of the powerful. He is now set to carry that instinct into government. The implications for Britain, a country in need of renewal, not retrenchment, are dire." Unquote. Specifically, the writer describes a career in which Starmer consistently took the side of the state in several headline cases of abuses of power, especially by the police. As Labour Party leader, Starmer, quote, "has begun a merciless crackdown on the mildest forms of internal dissent. He expelled his predecessor, blocked left-wing candidates from standing for parliament, proscribed various socialist groups, barred politicians from joining picket lines, and introduced anti-democratic rules for leadership elections. He has also demanded a stifling level of ideological conformity," unquote. He can be expected to come down hard on peace and other protesters. For all that, Britain has bucked the rightward march on the continent. Whether a Labour government will deliver benefits for the working class remains to be seen. Starmer will have a 170-seat majority in Parliament. But observers agree on this much. Starmer and Labour must deliver on meaningful changes very quickly. The British people are impatient. One side note, Britain's new Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, had very harsh words for Donald Trump in a Time magazine interview in 2018. Trump, he said, is not only a woman-hating, neo-Nazi sympathizing sociopath, he is also a profound threat to the international order, unquote. But more recently, he said that, of course, he would work with the U.S. and try to use his influence with a Trump administration. The French elections, something happened. The second round of voting, July 7, seemed anticlimactic. The far-right National Rally Party was on the way to dominating the French National Assembly. But it didn't happen, defying all the predictions and hand-wringing. Let's go back a few weeks. In the wake of the far-right's impressive gains in elections for the European Parliament, French President Emmanuel Macron called a snap election for the country's parliament. He hoped that the French people would unite behind a centrist message, but the first round of voting seemed to dash those hopes. The National Rally won about 34% of the vote, with the left New Popular Front second at 28%, and Macron's Together Alliance only winning 20% of the vote. The only question seemed to be whether Marine Le Pen, the National Rally leader, would have enough of a margin to elect the next prime minister, or would find another anti-immigrant, anti-European Union party, and thus rule for the first time since World War II. Macron does not have to step down as president until 2027, but his power would be sharply limited under the French system, and Le Pen has vowed to make it so. But the outcome July 7 gave first place to the leftist New Popular Front, with 178 seats, Macron's centrist alliance placed second with 150 seats, and the National Rally third with 142 seats. No party commands a majority, however, meaning a lot of horse trading as each group seeks coalition partners. For the president, it means finding a prime minister who can bring together enough votes to conduct the government's business. Explanations of this astounding outcome vary. Some observers believe Macron's call for popular demonstrations against the far right resounded among French voters. Others point to the fear evoked by the National Rally's program, which includes a so-called national preference, giving French citizens priority over immigrants and all non-citizens in access to public services. Le Pen's father had backed that policy years earlier. There is also the possibility that the far right's relations with Russia raised eyebrows among the electorate. Prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the party and Le Pen specifically were very friendly toward Russia, even accepting a 9 million euro loan from a Russian bank. Since then, Le Pen insists that she and the party have a wholly different attitude. Party leader Jordan Bardella has described Russia as a multidimensional threat, both for France and Europe, vowing to be extremely vigilant against any Russian attempts to interfere with French interests. But the party opposes sending French troops into Ukrainian territory and the delivery of long-range weapons that could be used to hit Russia. In Israel, a ruling on conscription and a potential explosion in the West Bank. The decision of Israel's Supreme Court that the Haredi, the ultra-religious Jews, must serve in the military could be a threshold event in Netanyahu's tenure. Israel's Attorney General immediately ordered the start of conscription, 3,000 now and a government plan for more later. She also ordered an immediate halt to government financing of yeshivas, where young Haredi study in lieu of military service or work. About 10,000 of these young people have claimed exemption even though they don't actually study in yeshivas at all. Netanyahu's government depends on the support of the ultra-religious parties and the far-right members of his cabinet. Should either of these groups bolt, his leadership is in deep trouble. The two pillars upon which Netanyahu's political career rests, religious Zionism and the Haredim, are in a life-and-death conflict with one another and feel mutually betrayed. So writes Ravit Hecht in the liberal newspaper Haaretz. The far right strongly supports settler violence in the West Bank. Nicholas Kristof writes in the New York Times about the horrific situation there, with Israeli settlers setting fire to people's homes and orchards and outright killing Palestinians, sometimes with Israeli soldiers standing by. It's state-sponsored terrorism, pure and simple. Since October 7, according to the United Nations, quote, 536 Palestinians, including 130 children in the West Bank, have been killed by Israeli forces or settlers. During the same period, 7 Israeli soldiers and 5 settlers have been killed by Palestinians. One way of thinking of it, an average of about 60 Palestinians have been killed each month in the West Bank since early October, in an area nominally at peace, unquote. 3 million Palestinians and 720,000 Israelis live in the West Bank. With the far right's 2 cabinet ministers in the lead, the Netanyahu government is creeping closer to annexing the West Bank and thus eliminating the possibility of a Palestinian state there. It has taken 3 actions. First, Israel just legalized what is to most countries illegal, 5 Jewish settlements. One group that tracks settler activity reports that with the authority of Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, Israel has made the largest land grab in the West Bank in 30 years. According to the New York Times, Smotrich also has agreed to release funds he has been withholding from the financially strapped Palestinian Authority, which administers some West Bank areas under Israeli military rule, in exchange for strengthening Israeli settlements in the territory. That has been Smotrich's plan for some time, substituting civilian for military authority and thereby converting occupied land into formally Israeli land.
What the Netanyahu government is doing in the West Bank is a recipe for another Palestinian uprising. In other news, corruption in China's military. China's last two defense ministers have been removed from the Chinese Communist Party on corruption charges. But this action could be just the beginning. As the New York Times reports, quote, both men were stripped of their military ranks and expelled from the party, and their cases were sent to military prosecutors, meaning almost inevitably that both will be put on trial, found guilty, and given heavy sentences, even death sentences, if their crimes are judged to be especially severe. The statements also suggested that their misdeeds amounted to a betrayal of Xi Jinping, who is chairman of the Central Military Commission, as well as party leader. Both generals had been members of the commission, and both were accused of betraying the party's basic principles. Not coincidentally, these charges come in the wake of a speech by Xi Jinping on the military's political leadership in late June, in which he stressed that, quote, political army building is the foundation of the People's Army, and the gun must always be in the hands of those who are loyal and reliable to the party. Classic Maoist priorities. Iran may be expanding its nuclear program. International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors of Iran's nuclear facilities are reporting a major expansion of the country's nuclear enrichment capability at its Fordow plant. Fordow is built deep underground, making it practically invulnerable to attack. If that expansion continues, it may triple production of enriched uranium and thus quicken Iran's ability to assemble a nuclear weapon arsenal. Iran has also indicated it will expand enrichment at its premier nuclear site, Natanz. It's generally agreed that Iran now has the technical know-how and enough highly enriched uranium to undertake nuclear bomb production in days. But intelligence officials also believe it might take Iran roughly 2 years to build a nuclear warhead that could be fitted onto a missile. The timeline might be considerably shorter, however, if Russia or North Korea chooses to help. Now that Iran has a new and relatively moderate president, it will be interesting to see if Iran slows its nuclear program and provides an opportunity for Iran and the United States to resume nuclear weapon talks. The U.S. restricts Ukrainian attacks inside Russia. Key Russian air bases are out of bounds for Ukrainian counterattacks, in particular those bases that are responsible for recent bombardments of major Ukrainian cities. That's the rule from the Biden administration, even though it recently gave Ukraine the green light to use U.S. weapons to attack targets inside Russia. What the new rule amounts to is that while Russia remains free to attack anywhere and any target in Ukraine, Ukraine must abide by restrictions that the U.S. has imposed, apparently to avoid triggering a Russian retaliation against a NATO target. President Biden makes a bold move on immigration. In the midst of a presidential campaign that has gone south, President Biden continues to make some positive, humane decisions. By executive action, the undocumented spouses of American citizens will be able to obtain green cards, that is, apply for legal residency without leaving the United States. About 500,000 undocumented spouses and 50,000 undocumented stepchildren of U.S. citizens are expected to be eligible to apply. Immigration advocates are quite pleased with Biden's move since it keeps families, overwhelmingly from Mexico, together. And it contrasts with other unwelcome steps, such as restricting asylum applications, that were more in line with Trump's policies. Finally, more condemnations of Russian war crimes in Ukraine. The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for two more Russian officials. They are former Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and Valery Gerasimov, chief of the General Staff of the Russian Armed Forces. The warrants charge them with multiple attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure. Last year, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Vladimir Putin and his Commissioner for Children's Rights on the war crime of transporting Ukrainian children to Russia. Russia is not one of the 124 signatories to the Rome Treaty that established the International Criminal Court. Meantime, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which has 57 member states, including Russia and Ukraine, has also weighed in on Russia's aggression. The organization's parliamentary assembly calls it genocide and says the decolonization of Russia is a necessary precondition for establishing peace in Ukraine. Decolonization means giving up occupied portions of Ukraine. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is Cable News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Some economists believe that the Federal Reserve's policy of sticking with high interest rates is a sound and reasonable one. But increasingly, many others are saying the high rates could end up crashing the economy. Thomas Ferguson is the policy director at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. Along with his colleague Servas Storm, he says the Fed's monetary tightening reinforces the dual nature of the U.S. economy. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the Fed's inflation-fighting strategy and related issues.
What's the Fed doing about inflation? Are they pursuing policies that would help the economy, do you think? Or I guess you've suggested they're playing chicken.
Well, my colleague Servas Storm and I wrote a piece, actually a couple of pieces on this, so it's not just my view here. But, you know, I'm sure they're trying to help the economy, we all trust. But no, I don't think they are. There's not much of a secret about this either. Almost every day now comes somebody's pronouncement, even sometimes inside the Fed structures itself, saying, you know, we're holding interest rates up rather too long. And you know, why would you run the risk of a recession, as one economist said the other day? Yeah, I mean, so our take on this is, why indeed are they doing it? Now, our answer is somewhat different within the standard story, which is, look, it's when you sort of look at what's actually happened, you can see that a big amount of inflation has dropped a lot. I mean, the so-called supply-side components are way down. On the other hand, service sector inflation is very sticky. It's much higher than the general rate of inflation. That bugs the Fed. That's pretty clear. It would bug anybody. When you sort of then probe a little bit further beneath that, you can sort of see, well, they pretty clearly think they have a wage price problem in that sector. That is to say, you have to catch up on workers. There are folks who disagree with that, but they're not in the majority. And I mean, not only the Fed, but nearly everybody in sort of mainstream economics spends most of their time agonizing about wage price spirals when, you know, the big story in the last 3 years has been we're all behind on average. I mean, workers have lost a lot.
That hasn't happened in a long time, right? That traditional or classic wage price
spiral? No, that's right. No, you're right. And it's like this has not been the problem in this last few years. And anyway, back to the sort of main thread, which is that so Servas and I just looked at this and said, well, you know what? The problem here is pretty straightforward. Just take everybody's normal estimates of what so-called wealth effects are. Wealth effect meaning the extra impact on consumption spending. That are spending in general, but certainly consumption spending mostly, that you're going to get from a big increase in wealth. And then when you look at that, you see, good Lord, since 2020, when the Fed did its huge quantitative easing program, again, it briefly came out of it, then went right back into it. First, the housing markets, and then also the financial markets soared. They're both near records right now. Not today, I think they fell a tiny amount from where they were last week. They were at records last week. And just take that normal estimate of spending and then plug it into the big numbers that you actually see in wealth, and you get absolutely stunning numbers there. And folks don't talk about this. They don't recognize it. Huge numbers of people enormously resented it when we first brought it up. Fed still doesn't want to acknowledge it. And you can see how gingerly, I've had discussions with reporters, for example, where they talk quite straightforwardly to me about this. Then they actually will bring it up with somebody else from the Fed, but they don't write about it. They don't want to discuss specific arguments, say those in our paper. people know this is happening. You know, you get economists now, even in Visa and elsewhere, saying this. And so our take is, look, why don't we recognize that a huge chunk of this service sector inflation, the sticky price qualities of that, are coming from this giant surge in spending. And the thing you got to recognize about that is that this giant surge in spending is not going to go away by raising interest rates. I mean, unless you want to crash the whole economy. I mean, you can obviously wreck the wealth in the whole place. You can do a Paul Volcker style 1979-1980 giant rate rises. What? They're not doing that. In fact, what the Fed does is they sort of keep it where it is. They don't cut it. And they're really just sort of sitting around looking for something to turn up, hoping that maybe something will drop. Because, I mean, I think they see, too, the problem. And so that's our point, that, hey, guys, we need a better way to deal with this type of problem than just this sort of stupid tool of raising interest rates, which, when it's spending from the wealthy in the face of record stock and housing markets, well, just forget it. That's not going to cure the problem. It just won't. You can talk until you're blue in the face, but it won't change that fact.
So how does the Fed policy affect most of the population, not the big investors, not the super wealthy?
All right. I mean, it wasn't me. It was Claudia Sahm the other day, a former Fed economist, who kept pointing out to the steady rise in unemployment. And it's obviously costing everybody on every interest rate that's hitched. You know, it's one of the miracles of inflation accounting that typically interest rates don't actually show in things like the CPI. There are good reasons for that. There are a lot of, I think, also bad reasons that they ought not to, because they used to be in there at one point. But the point is, no, we're all paying, the rest of us are all paying. And in effect, what you've got here is a dual economy. I mean, another point that sort of Storm and I made in our paper, which is on the INET website, I guess I should add. You've got, in effect, one economy for the rich and the other, and another economy for everybody else. And you can see the sort of craziness of this over time. I mean, the wealth effects and spending effects are now so huge. They are restructuring very substantial chunks of the economy. You can see, for example, that, you know, you go back to, say, 2018, 19, 20 as a baseline, the employment in nursing homes and wages have just not recovered. What you're doing is you're pulling a lot of low wage workers out of stuff where they used to do reasonable social stuff with a reasonable effects on society at large, including daycare, and you're pulling them into things like high end dining. I mean, at this point, waiving small details like any number of chains that you and I can probably make up, but which we will not push any in particular here, waiving a few chains. Almost all dining has become high-end dining now. You know, it's like this, just growing this can't make sense, I think, over the long run. But anyway, that's what we're doing. The whole economy is restructuring under the effect of wealth, but the wealth effect on consumption spending is very large. And so that inflation in service sectors is going to stay up for a long time. You need something else to deal with it.
So this idea that there's two economies, one for the very wealthy and one for the rest of us, is that any different than what's existed before? Or do you think it's just to a greater degree?
It's worse. And in particular, this. Now, this goes back to a couple papers that, again, I think Servais and I wrote a year ago. We're not the only ones to observe this. Is I actually think a lot of low-wage sectors are collapsing and or sectors where they can't keep wages up high enough. That actually, as weird as this sounds, also covers a good bit of healthcare, because you can see that the job conditions, now this is not just a question of, if you like, price adjustment in an existing structure. Healthcare is going through a structural transformation as private equity gobbles more and more of it. And so what you see is that the healthcare executive's pay tends to stay up almost regardless, while nurses and even doctors are complaining, and they're all beefing about both safety and hours. I mean, it's just crazy to have people doing like 6-day shifts or full day shifts.
But in the case of nurses, they do have unions in many cases that can negotiate for them.
In some cases, yes. But the general, I think there's no doubt at all that there's a very substantial flow of people out of nursing. There's not one, but many complaints about this and many studies of it. And indeed, I just saw this morning a demand, well, let's change law on visas so we can get more foreign nurses in. We can certainly use nurses. I'm equivocal about pulling nurses from other countries. What you do is you pull them out, typically out of developing countries, which don't have any then. But they should solve these problems. Now, I don't think collective bargaining is going to fix this. Collective bargaining has not fixed it now for 2 or 3 years. And indeed, you can see there are even some strikes over this. You don't need strikes. We have a bankruptcy in southeastern Massachusetts right now. That is by where the executives have done extremely well. It was a private equity operation that then sold it off, and Stewart Healthcare. It's all over the news everywhere in the Northeast. And it's even shown up, I think, in some congressional hearings. This kind of stuff's all over. Healthcare is just one place, though. Just in general, there are a bunch of sectors, I think, where this is true. Nursing homes is another one, which is really scary. They just can't retain people, as far as I can tell. And in educational institutions, there's a steady attrition, though not everywhere. It depends on what district you're in. You're in a fairly rich suburban district. Your wages generally rise, though maybe not to completely cover. In poorer districts, that's not obvious at all. And universities are straggled out all over the place.
Does what you're talking about with the Fed and related issues, do those sort of issues come up in political campaigns? Have you seen that at all?
Well, it depends.
Or maybe in an indirect way?
Indirectly, a lot, right? It's clear. You see the Biden administration's economists are claiming all these wage gains for people. Now, there are all these discussions of why people don't buy it. In fact, as Storm and I showed you in great detail in our long paper there, the working paper, and I know. These wage gains are largely illusory. Most people have lost under inflation. I'm just repeating that point in that context makes the point very clear. When I look around the world at the European elections, including the UK, basically what I'm seeing is that hardly any party that presided over inflation has really survived. The sort of periodic or the crux of the issue in this election is to a considerable extent, I think, if it's just a referendum on economic reforms, it's not going to go super well for Biden. But it's probably not just a referendum on economic. It's not like brand X. It's not another one of these in-out, out-in deals where you just vote for the out party and just don't worry about it. Everybody knows what those are. But I'm not willing myself to go into politics either. I'm old-fashioned. I think we should stick to the economic side of this. And that I'm happy to talk about. But yeah, I think inflation is an issue. It was an issue. It's striking the way press coverage in the United States of the European elections, both the recent European parliamentary elections and more specifically now the French elections, they carry on as though the issue were principally immigration. If you can read even a little French, that's not true. The question of
it's what the right wing emphasizes, but yeah.
Yeah, everybody out of power is emphasizing it. And, it's pretty obvious. It's not easy to be a regime with high inflation. Now, you can come back, and I'm sympathetic only up to a point on this, you had, supply shortages, supply side problems, which, that's what Storman, I think, too, is a basic cause of the inflation. I think, on the other hand, people could have dealt with that better. I would have, in particular, insisted on port restructurings and forcing the carriers to cooperate much faster than people did. And I'm going to leave that to other people. I think Peter Goodman's new book on supply problems in the world economy has some discussions of that. But that's a different discussion.
So in the U.S., at least, or maybe in other countries, do you think we'll ever get away from this idea that if the economy is perceived to be good, the president gets credit, and if the economy is perceived to be bad, the president is blamed. Is that going to continue, do you think?
Well, we're all going to find out, I think. I'm not a believer in that as a sort of infallible rule. I mean, I've been looking at elections for a long time, and I certainly got the point of the old economic theories of elections, which was basically, I mean, the old versions of that sort of depended usually on median disposable income in the last few quarters before the election. Median's okay, but the average ones, you know, that has become kind of a strange yardstick as incomes have become so fantastically unequal. But if you can get it, and you can't really in enough time to do good election predictions, you might be able to make something. But they don't explain everything. There's always stuff floating around. I mean, I'm a big believer in the role of money in elections. And, you know, Paul Jorgensen and G. Chen and I have published a lot on that. And, you know, we find the correlation of campaign spending in House elections, where you've got hundreds of cases, not one-offs, to be very strong, usually like 80.8, things like that, which is a very high level. That said, you know, there's still enough. That means, you know, the other part is still out there. And look, I'm going to tell you right now, I just abstract, but this is not a political comment of any kind. It's almost a statistical story. When you have an election as close as this one appears to be right now, one wants to say it's almost random. I mean, that we're looking for somebody to just make a mistake and some dumb thing will happen, you know, a stumble coming on or off an airplane. I am not happy about this, but that's where, if anybody tells you they can tell you the outcome of this election right now, don't believe them.
That was Thomas Ferguson of the Institute for New Economic Thinking speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being here.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
To KABU for our annual live broadcast of the Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, broadcasting from